Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at weather. We'll look back and then look at the current and probably try and look ahead a little bit, too. In the last 12 months, you think back, we've had tornadoes. We've had air quality issues, pretty persistent, historic rainfalls, late summer, early winter. Dangerous cold lately and brutal winds. And and normally John Martin would be one of our weather guys would be with us today to talk about it. But Steve Ackerman is here, our other weather guy, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. Steve, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. It's great to have him back. He's been doing this a long time with us. And as we move along for the next hour, I hope you'll join in. How are you making sense of this weather? Do you have some questions about weather or climate? Or maybe you've got a photo you want to share. Mm-hmm. We always love those. You can, if you want to send a photo or email us a question or send a photo, you can go to talk@wpr.org. Just type in talk@wpr.org and we'll get it. But we'd also love to hear from you by phone. And if you have a question or a comment, maybe an experience to share about what's happening lately or before, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or, again, send an email or photo to talk@wpr.org. Steve Ackerman, great to have you back.
It's great to be here in this warm studio.
Now I'm assuming that John Martin probably couldn't get his car started this morning, or maybe his pipes froze.
He is, believe it or not, he loves winter, and so there's a winter field campaign, you know, where we go out and make observations by planes and things like that, and I believe he's up in the Arctic, so this isn't cold enough for him.
So he's in the Arctic.
Yes, right. Studying the weather so that we can predict these cold weathers better, even better than what we do now, which is pretty good.
Well, yeah, which is pretty darn good. But he'll have some good stories to tell, hopefully, next month when he comes back.
Yeah, of being up there. It's an international field program, as I understand it. So, he'll have some good stories.
So what do you do? Does he wet his finger and stick it up in the air, or what do they do with this? And you don't know exactly, I'm sure. But
yeah, but typically what you do in these field programs is you're studying a particular weather event. So, for example, many years ago, we were studying contrails, you know, things that come behind jets. And so we had our own jet from NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And we would look at what the weather was, what the environmental conditions were, what the humidity was up in the atmosphere. And then we would, follow behind jets that were laying down these contrails and penetrate them and make observations of the ice crystals that were in there. So you're trying to get a really detailed set of the environment, of the weather feature that you're studying. And then you go back and look at, what did we observe? What do our models say? Where are we wrong, and how can we improve that?
Hmm. And you let the pilots know and the ones that you're following that you...
we do that. That field program in particular, which was back in the 90s, it was really interesting because they were laying down, you know, it was a jet that we controlled, not a passenger jet.
Yeah.
And they had a contrail behind them, and there were two contrails coming out. And the plane that was doing the probes on it to look at the ice crystal sizes, you know, would come up very slowly, and then all of a sudden it would enter it. And they look like tubes, like big, long tubes. And it was really interesting. And then all of a sudden the measurement, the plane that's making the measurements got out of sync a little bit, and then the whole thing gets thrown out. And it's twirling down. It's looked like it's, you know, it's flipping over just like an aerobatic plane. And that's when I realized I don't want to ever go on that one, right? Because I'll throw up.
So a contrail is a tooth?
Yeah. It's just
I didn't know that.
You usually think of it as a solid thing, but what the airplanes were showing, because it's a circulation pattern. It's a vortex that's coming off. And so that's how they form in the vortex.
Well, here we are in this bitterly cold. I was looking, I looked up for Madison and some other places. Madison on this past Friday, for example, had 18 below, which was not a record.
No, yeah.
I think it was in the 20s.
Yeah, minus 22, I think. Maybe.
27. Yeah. And
27.
Ashland was 26 below. Look that up. Milwaukee was 18 below. Superior was 27 below.
It's cold.
So why?
Well, what we get into is the meandering of the jet stream. And this is probably, I'm going to guess, is what John is studying, what they're looking mm-hmm. at, because that's one of his areas of expertise. And when it dips down, this cold polar air, Arctic air, can sweep on down into the U.S. And if there's moisture available along these front lines, then you get the heavy precipitation that we're now seeing in the south. And in this case, it's snow because it's cold down there as well.
Well, it's cold.
And
cold air sinks.
And cold air sinks, and it sits down on the ground. The other thing, I was looking at the Wisconsin Climate Office website. You know, sort of the same thing you were doing. You know, like looking at where does it get really, really cold. And one of the things that they had plotted up, which I found fascinating, is they were looking at records for each month. What was the coldest and the hottest in that time period, that year and that month? And what is that gap? And as it turns out, that gap, because of global warming, that range between the maximum and the minimum is going down. So it's becoming less variable, even though it's really variable because we're still getting minus 20 degree temperatures. But that range, that variability is getting smaller.
So, and that's because of climate change?
Yep, yeah. So our cold, you know, is getting warmer, and our hots are getting hotter, but not as hot. Yeah, so it's when you get really cold like this and you're stuck at home trying to stay warm, you kind of go on the web and look around for what can you find out about how cold it is.
You know, last winter, if I remember correctly, we didn't get a lot of snow.
We didn't. We were. We started off cold last. I remember from 2025. We started off cold, but yeah, we didn't get as much precipitation as we normally do. I think it was around 2 feet of precipitation.
I think last year we did have plant problems. I'm wondering about, you know, and you're not a botanist, but I the kind of cold. At least we have some snow on the ground and. Every place
I think throughout most of the state. That's the good thing about snowfall. With the snow we've gotten, it tends to do an insulation so the ground doesn't get as cold.
And early autumn, I'm just thinking back now, this last year, seemed particularly hot or warm, at least, throughout much of the state. Why was that?
Yeah. I don't remember. I think it was probably associated with sunniness as well as warm air pockets. So sometimes when you get these high pressure systems, when they move into an area, they're hard to get out of there. So they stay around for a while. And that's probably what led to that in a combination with clear skies.
Well, it just gives me the chance to brag again, because November 7th is when I got my first hole-in-one ever at a golf course.
Your first one?
Yeah. Well,
congratulations first.
Had a lot of close ones, but, you know, I don't think I had a jacket on.
Wow. In November?
November 7th.
Jeez. So was the ground hard? Did the ball bounce a lot? Is that why you were able to...
I don't know. It was 170 yards away, and I didn't know that I did hit it. And the person I was playing with said, I think it went over. So we walked across the green and didn't even look, and were searching around on the other side of the green. And then I said, I can't find it. Maybe it's in the hole. And I went and looked, and it was in the hole.
Did the person you were golfing with think you were joking when you said maybe it's in the hole?
Well, we all jumped up and down. She took a nice picture. And I immediately raced to Facebook to post my my photo. Well, not immediately, but it was the next morning, I think.
So what's the tradition? I know we're getting off the topic of weather here, but what's the tradition of getting a hole in one? Do you have to buy drinks for the house
for everybody
afterwards?
There, yeah. And fortunately for me, I was golfing with seven other people only, and there were like three or four other people in the bar.
Yeah, I mean, it's November.
I could be in Wisconsin.
Why are you golfing?
I could be really generous and say, give everybody a drink. Oh man, but it was warm. I mean that, and it was warm until it wasn't, and then it was really cold.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we had a really warm period too, end of July, early August, in 2025.
Yeah, and we had
fire too, right? The Canadian fires.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to bring that up. Is we had air quality.
Yeah.
Advisories over the summer. How bad was that overall?
It was bad in the sense when you're issuing in air quality issues, you know there's problems if you have asthma or other breathing issues. And that wasn't from, I was going to say pollution, but actually it is because it's from fires.
A lot of it
was coming from smoke. And that's a real irritant in the lungs, particularly if you have asthma or other conditions.
Yeah.
And you could smell it, and you can see it in satellite imagery.
Yeah, we had a nine-day streak, 9 days in a row of air quality issues.
Yeah.
I know that. Pat in Ellsworth, Iowa, emailed us, wonders if you can explain why we experience frost when the temperature doesn't go down to 32 degrees. We'll have frost.
Oh, yeah, good question. And the reason why is that the temperatures are made at about 3 feet above the ground, the official temperatures. So when we're reporting air temperatures, we're not reporting the air closest to the ground. And a lot of times, particularly in the early evening, early mornings, or late evenings, early mornings, the ground is radiating energy. And so the ground surface will be cooler than the air above.
Oh.
And in particular, with like blades of grass and things like that, those three-dimensional structures will even get colder. And so a lot of times you'll even see frost on the grass and not on the nearby patio, for example. And a lot of that's associated with the cooling associated with the grass blades, which are pointed and therefore more surface area and get colder even quicker.
Yeah, that was Pat in Epworth, Iowa, who emailed that question. Joe in Medford has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
I have a quick question. It may not be in the realm of general knowledge by our guest today, but isn't there some strong positive link between periods of very cold, extended cold periods of weather temperatures that kill off a lot of the parasitic critters in the forest, like ticks and ash borers and Asian beetles and termites and wasps and other critters that we don't like? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, I think it would have to be really cold and really extended and maybe an invasive species because, you know, we're not getting as cold as we have been in the past. And so I think the native species will be able to survive even these really cold winters.
Yeah, I think you need, well, I'm trying to remember my insects, but I think you need, you can throw insects in a freezer and if you don't leave them in there for 24 hours, you can take them back out and they're still gone.
Yeah, yeah. Now, having said that, I've been following the bee societies, the honeybee societies, or bumblebee societies, and they recommend, you know, they need protections during the winter. The queens do because they're the only ones that survive, and so they always recommend ways to, you know, not clear your garden of everything, but leave some flower stalks off so that they can go in there and survive the winter.
Yeah. Steve Ackerman, our weather guy, our guest today. Great as we talk with him, climate and weather. And you can join in too. Questions, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like to email a question or maybe even email a weather photo, we'd love that as well. Go to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at weather and climate today with one of our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at the UW-Madison, formerly that, and he's an Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Questions? Give us an email at talk@WPR.org or send a photo. Our lines are filling up. The number is 800-642-1234. Kay and Madison, we'll go to you. What's on your mind?
I am something of a weather geek myself, thanks to the UW and the Coast Guard. My question is, in overflights over the Arctic, as in from London, someone once told me that there's some kind of emissions from the contrails that land on the glaciers and maybe are helping melting them. Do contrails have any effect on that?
No, not that I'm aware of, because the contrails are usually pretty high up. And so if you watch them as a weather geek, as you classify yourself, which is great, you'll see a lot of times they'll just dissipate. And then there is particles in there that may stay around, but won't really get to glaciers and warm them. What becomes a problem with glaciers, and this is something I studied many years ago, dust storms that we get out of the deserts can find their way up into the Alps, and even big storms will get into the glaciers up in the Arctic or Antarctic. And when that settles on the ice sheets there, it'll help help warm them up and therefore melt them, support the melting.
So the melting isn't from contrails, it's from desert
dust
storms.
And pollution.
Yeah, dust and pollution.
Yeah.
Oh. And the contrails themselves are mostly water vapor, aren't they?
They are, but they usually have to crystallize on something. And so there are small particles, aerosol particles in there. But there isn't enough contrails to really lead to that kind of impact on glaciers.
Got it. Kay, thank you for that question. Rana in Rice Lake, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rana.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
So I'm wondering if there is a similarity or relationship between fog and, I think it's called sea steam. We had it on Lake Superior not too long ago, and they just look so similar, but I don't think they're the same. Thank you.
They are both types of fog, different types of fog in terms of how they form. So fogs form when the air cools down, and eventually as it cools down, it reaches saturation or humidity of 100%. And at that point, aerosols in the air, they're small and they're low concentrations, but they'll cause a condensation and a fog particle, liquid particle to form. In steam fog, so it's the same process. You got to get to humidity to 100%. But the steam fog is usually over water that's warmer, that hasn't frozen yet. And so there's slight convective or uprisings over the lake because it's so warm and the air above is cold. And as that rises, again, as the air lifts, it also cools. The cooling reaches 100% saturation, and then the cloud droplets form. So they are the same. They look the same. Although the steam fog, what I've seen generally, you know, you could almost see it moving up, where a lot of times fogs coming out of a marsh are kind of moving sideways and very flat at the top.
Yeah. Rana, there you go. Thank you so much. That's interesting. Lloyd in Athens, we'll go to you next. Hi, Lloyd.
Good morning. Yeah. Well, last Tuesday, I was driving eastward as the sun was just starting. It hadn't come up, but it was almost ready to break the horizon. And directly above the sun was like a brilliant torch, like in the shape of a long candle. And it was just very, very bright. There were, of course, sun dogs off on each side.
Yeah.
But I've never seen that torch above the sun like that before.
Yeah, you can get that. Like you said, there's oftentimes the sun dogs, which are the like rainbows off to the side. And they're, that torch that you're talking about, there's a formal name for it, a meteorological name, and it's escaping me right now. But it's the same process, except you're not getting that rainbow of effect, the color effect, because you're not getting the color separations.
Oh.
And in fact, it's last night.
Anne emailed us with a question about this beautiful and very tall sun pillar yesterday at sunset in Madison and wondered what causes them and are they more common in winter or super cold weather?
They're common in winter. You need cold weather. And I'll bet, Lloyd, this is similar to what you were seeing for the same explanation. And that is in the sun pillar, what we have is the sun goes down, you know, the blue light gets scattered out, and so we're just left with the oranges and the reds. And as it gets to the horizon, there's a very thin layer of, because it's so cold, ice crystals that are floating in the air. And they're in the shape of, they're flat, so they're in shape of, you know, flat layer. We call them plates, although they're six-sided. And they're floating horizontally. And so as the sun sets, it has light beams that normally would just go straight up and straight out that we would never see where we are. But in this case, it hits the bottom of those ice crystals and then reflects off of it. And the angle of incidence is the angles of reflection, which is a basic property. And so we end up seeing that the light that they normally would not see being reflected off of those ice crystals. And the one last night was huge. I mean, very, very long. And you need cold, very cold environments to get those types of ice crystals to form. So we can get them at any time in winter time when it's below freezing. But I think this really cold weather that we've been having has really helped get the length of those so that the column of atmosphere is just filled with those thin ice plates.
I miss that.
Yeah,
I unfortunately was at the Kohl Center watching Wisconsin lose to USC in basketball. So
I had just come out of the movies, and then there it was. And then people that we went to the movies with ended up calling us and saying, "What's that thing above the sun?"
Kevin in Madison has something for us. Kevin, hi.
Yes, hi there. I was a Four Seasons biker, which in Wisconsin, that's saying something. And I was going down Highway 14, and I stopped to rest a while, and I was in Lone Rock. And they're quite proud of it. They've got it on their billboards, but it was the coldest recorded temperature in the lower 48. They said back in the 1940s, it was some decades ago. But what it was is that it was so cold that they don't have an official recorded temperature because the thermometers didn't go down that low. But they had to make estimates because of the damage to the trees and metal and stuff like that. And I was wondering if our weather guy has heard of that phenomenon about Lone Rock, Wisconsin, and how cold it got.
I had not heard about that, and I will definitely look into that. One thing that you mentioned, though, that is really relevant as well is, you know, you said it wasn't the official cold one. And the National Weather Service and NOAA maintain official meteorological observation sites. And so when we had that big rainfall in August, and we set a new record of 11 or 13 inches or something, I got an email immediately from somebody saying, wait a minute, what about this rainfall that we had in, I think it was in Springfield, or I forget where it was now, but it was measured at over that 13, 14 inches. And the answer is, yeah, you can have these record events, but if it's not an official site where NOAA NWS has actually gone out and looked at the instruments and the area around it, because they want that consistency, then oftentimes it won't get set as a state record.
Do you know offhand what the state record is?
I want to say it's minus 50 something, but I'm not totally sure. And hopefully Ed, who's
minus
listening, 50, will call.
Yeah, it's minus 55.
Minus 55.
Jeff Robbins tells me.
Oh, it is. Okay. So it is that.
Wow. Well,
but
Kevin,
I'll look that up because I had not heard about that.
And yeah. And Kevin, thanks again for that, because it also brings to mind questions about trees
blowing up.
People saying, yeah. "Oh, the trees are blowing up." They don't really blow up, but
they don't blow up, right? They don't explode.
They
can crack as it gets so cold, and the sap inside, if it does get to the point where the sap is going to freeze, when something freezes, it expands. And so when it expands, it'll get a crack. And you'll get a big sound, but it's not the trees blowing up. It's just the sap freezing.
I wonder if there's any of that. You know, we've got all these sugar bushes around with maple trees with, you know, a maple tree is not thick bark. It's not a thick bark tree.
And I think you'll see them in the scars in the trees. So the trees will survive, but they'll be damaged and they'll get a scar and they'll keep on living.
One of my neighbors had that
had
very
scar.
Thing happen, and they wound up pruning a tree at the base.
Oh.
It stayed for many a year, but finally it just, that was the end of it. Kevin, thanks again. Appreciate your call. We did have a photo, and I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, from Vivian. This picture was taken in Green Bay early summer of 2024, and it looks almost like a corkscrew cloud.
It looks very much like it's called corkscrew cloud, and I'm wondering, again, it looks like, unless it was done intentionally, which it probably wasn't, but it's going vertical. So I wonder if there wasn't a rocket-type launch, whether a hobby rocket.
Maybe.
You know, maybe not a NASA-type rocket, but some other type of rocket that went up there. I'll bet you that's what it was, because they're... The corkscrew nature of that indicates that there was a strong vertical circulation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Vivian said it, the cloud totally dispersed within minutes.
Yeah. So it's not saturated. It's caused rapid cooling, probably because the rocket or whatever it was going up so fast.
Robin Middleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Rob.
Thank you. As long as we're talking about record lows, I'm calling about an episode that happened in my old hometown, Rice Lake, Wisconsin, Northwest Wisconsin, on January 9th, 1977. Thankfully, I was here at school. But some kind of an event squatted right over the area with cold. And at the airport there, they unofficially measured minus 60. But apparently, it couldn't be official because they didn't have the right kind of thermometer. It had to be in something.
Yeah.
Yep. I had not heard that, but again, it doesn't surprise me too much because, we have to be an official record. You have to be at one of these sites that NOAA, NASA, National Weather Service, have designated as an official weather observing site.
At 60 below, I mean, if you spit... If you could spit.
If you could get enough water. Because you're right, it's probably very dry as well.
It's probably very dry, but that would freeze before it hit the ground, wouldn't it?
You know, you hear those statements, and that would definitely be a time you would want to try that.
Yeah, I don't know
or
if I'd want to be outside to try
and
it.
Maybe spit it out
I'll send
solid.
Jeff out and try it.
Right.
He's giving me a thumbs up. He'd do it. Oh, boy. Rob, thank you very much. Laura in Portage. We go to you now. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Oh, your show is wonderful. This is a happier note. It has to do with 8 tiny flying reindeer. And I have heard a scientific explanation for this phenomenon.
Okay.
And it has to do with that ice crystals at the horizon and a very cold, cold, cold day. And something about the way the sunlight goes through the ice crystals at the horizon is totally blurred. It's hard to tell which is sky and which is land. And if you see a herd of reindeer running, it may appear that they are flying in the sky. Does that sound okay?
What I think sounds okay is, first, I'm a believer in reindeers, but what you'll probably see is not the physical of reindeer, but the sparkling from their bells and their harnesses that they have on their neck. That's probably what you're seeing, because they'd be too far away to see the, you know, the brown spots and the antlers and things. But the sparkle light coming from their collars, I could imagine you'd be able to see.
Laura, there you go. Hey, thanks a lot for calling. I love that. I love that comment and question. We got Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Dean, hi.
Hi, good morning, and thanks again for the show. It was like a bunch of shocking news towards the end of the year. One with Larry retiring, which really blew me away. And second was NCARC closing due to, retribution for what Colorado's been politically towards Trump. And that was a shock for us, too. So much when I was growing up as a kid, I'd get a journal called Weatherwise, and I followed what was going on at NCAR because it is our national treasure of atmospheric research, and it's a terrible shame to see that closed.
Yeah, I don't think it's totally closed yet. There's been a lot of resistance to closing that down. I know there were also some cooperative institutes, research institutes between universities and NOAA and National Weather Service that were also claimed to be shut down. But then, people pointing out the importance, Congress getting involved, the local representatives have been able to keep them open for another year at least. And I think that's happening with NCAR as well. It's still threatened to be closed. But yeah, it's a disaster, because if we want to improve weather forecasting, and we've done a lot of improvements, we need those expertise of, one, making measurements. NCAR has these planes that would go out and make these observations in these big field programs. And the numerical expertise, I mean, the biggest computer was put at NCAR many years ago in order to support weather forecasting, because they had that infrastructure. And when that infrastructure goes away, it's not going to be good for the nation.
Yeah. Dean, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in. Finally have some open lines again. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we have some emails. Jeff in La Crosse emailed us. He had a weather and climate class at UW back in UW La Crosse back in 1975. And in the early part of the class, they talked about the seasons and how the length of daylight changed and the rate that it changed at. One thing he wonders about is why the rate of change isn't consistent. It slows down near the solstices and speeds up near the equinoxes.
Huh. So
why is that?
I think that's a question for your astronomer guests. But I think it has to do with the rotation of the Earth around the sun, because at different parts during our seasonal cycles, we're closer to the sun and then we're further away. And I think that'll influence how much daylight we have at any particular time of the year.
Well, here's one I'm sure you know. Russ emailed us. Has it ever rained fish in Wisconsin?
Has it? I could imagine. I don't know the official answer to this, but I could imagine a tornado going over a lake and scooping up water and fish, and then moving that overland and then dropping it.
I think it's happened. If you're listening in and can give us an example, call in and give us send us an email and give us an example, because I'm just in my head. I'm thinking of a story or two about raining that fish somewhere in our state.
Yeah.
Jeff reminds me, that's a plot line from Sharknado.
Oh.
oh man. Well, Lone Rock held the record for the coldest temperature in Wisconsin. This is an email. Until February 2nd of 1996, when Couderay recorded minus 55 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 48 Celsius.
Oh, okay. Who clarified that?
I don't know. No. But somebody
looked it up. That's good.
Yeah, somebody, it might have even been Jeff. Yeah. Robbins. I'm not positive. Well, and we've got some more. I thought we had Madeline and DePere. Maybe we don't. We've got a number of folks coming online with questions. Polar vortex. We often hear the term polar vortex in relation to those really cold stretches. Mm-hmm. And the polar vortex is what?
So the polar vortex, if you think of the jet stream, it goes around the pole. And in the winter time, we typically equate that with these cold air outbreaks that we get. So we'll have the polar vortex in the wintertime, that jet stream, which is normally, as you think of it, as a ring, whether it's straight or meandering, when wintertime comes, it moves southward because that's the energy budgets of the planet. And as it meanders, if it's running circular, then we don't have the polar vortex per se. But if we have a very meandering type of shape where it really dips down south, is where that really cold polar air is. And so that polar air then breaks out into down here into the U.S. and causes this really cold temperatures that we're experiencing.
And that's what we've got now.
Yeah, that's what we've got now, the polar vortex. The cold air associated with that.
Madeline and DePere, we've got her now. Let's go there. Hi, Madeline.
Yeah, I want to verify if this snowstorm happened when I thought it did. At the time, I was living with my parents on the Oneida Reservation on Moore Road, and it shows my dad and my neighbor standing by a humongous snowbank in our driveway, and the date on the picture that was developed says March of 1959. Did we get that much snow then?
March of 1950. And where'd you say? Lacouturay?
Oh, no. On the Oneida
Reservation. Oneida Reservation.
Northern.
Okay.
Boy, I'm not sure the answer of that. When I get a question like that or I have it, I reach out to the Wisconsin Climate Office because they typically keep those records, and so they have that knowledge. So if you have availability on the web or if you want to email me the picture, I'll reach out to them and ask them, hey, how much snow did we get on that date in 1959? Because I was living on Long Island at the time.
Madeline,
you didn't know I was from Long Island.
You can just send an email to talk at WPR.org if you can.
Yeah.
And then we'll look it up and get back to you. With the exact date, and we'll, or as close as you can.
Yeah.
And we'll, Steve will check it out.
I'll reach out to the real experts.
Oh, gosh. Steve Ackerman is an expert, and he's emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have him here as one of our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are having a great time talking weather and climate for our state with Steve Ackerman, former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education and Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Questions? Give a call, the number 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Greg in Vilas County, what's on your mind?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. You guys are great. I love it when you have these expert professionals on. And mostly a comment here, gentlemen. I was so depressed when I heard that NOAA, because I'm an avid listener of NOAA. I go into what I call the NOAA trance. It just loops and loops and loops, you know. When I first heard they were being defunded by the current administration, I was really depressed about that. I was like, how are we going to do this, you know? And then I started doing a little more research on it and kind of more listening on it. And I understand that it's going towards privatization so that the NOAA itself is going to be dwindled down to perhaps nothing someday. But the privatization companies, Corporation America, is going to take over, which would, I guess, would be able to utilize all the NOAA data from years gone by. What are your thoughts on that? And by the way, yes, we are having a true winter in northern Wisconsin. I'm from the
birthplace of the snowmobile up here in Vilas County. I love it when you talk weather.
Yeah.
Thanks, Greg.
It would be a disaster if they publicize, if they took NOAA and put it in private industry. There's no doubt in my mind about that. These weather observations, everybody needs them. It doesn't matter whether or not you can afford it, because that's what you'll go to, whether or not you can buy it or not. And my real opposition to this began over a decade ago when I happened to be at a meeting in England. And I looked out the window and it was raining. And I wondered to myself, oh, geez, I wonder how long this rain's going to last. So I went to get the radar. And I couldn't, because I had to pay for it. And, you know, how many people have NOAA's radar on their imagery? So you want to know when the rain is going to stop. You look it up. And then there it is. And if it becomes privatized, that's not going to happen. You're going to have to pay for it. And so, yeah, I think it would be a disaster. And not only that, to put the data, the climatic data hands into private industry only may at first be fine, but what the Europeans are finding out, it's becoming harder to get the climate data that the U.S. has because the current administration isn't making that easy or available. And so you then become more susceptible to what's going on in the current administration, of whether or not access to that data is easy or not easy. So yeah, it would be a problem. There are some things that should remain public.
And I think the private companies, for the most part, I mean, they rely on...
And I belong to private forecasters, yes, because they use that public data, and there are forecasters that I pay to get their forecast because I know that they're good forecasts, and they're using that free data.
Yeah.
That everybody essentially supports through their tax dollars.
Greg, thank you for calling. Duke and Spooner, your turn. Hi, Duke.
Hi, Larry. From the really serious to a lot more trivial, back in that 1977 cold snap, I was a young reporter working for the Cap Times, and the city editor asked me to write a story gathering information on how people were doing up north. And Hooper's had a trip up at Birchwood that weekend, and I remember one participant saying that he slept out on a porch that night at a cabin, an uninsulated porch, and finally gave up at 54 below. Now, that's anecdotal, but I remember calling another guy in the North Woods and asked him how he was doing. He said, well, I tell you, I went out to get some firewood this morning, and it was so cold I couldn't get my wheelbarrow started.
Oh, I love that, Duke. Thanks for calling.
You know, I'm remembering now in this 76-77 winter,
yeah.
I was in Colorado, in Fort Collins, and we actually had a really warm winter. And I think it was because the cold air was dipping over the Midwest. And again, the meandering of the polar jet stream means that we were under high pressure and very, very warm. I remember biking at the night up to the university there, which I never would do in January, but it was warm enough then that I actually did that.
Not here, though.
But not here, no.
Duke, thanks for those stories. Oh, that's great. I love to hear those. Appreciate it very much. Mark at Lake Geneva, what's on your mind?
I have, I think, an answer to why the time to the sunlight changes very little at the solstices, but very much at the equinox.
Okay.
The way I look at it is, if you took a plate and turned it upright, the very top of the plate and the very bottom of the plate, the height of the plate wouldn't change much at those two places, but it would change a great deal in the middle. The middle corresponds to the equinox, and the top and the bottom correspond to the solstices.
Yeah, that's a good way to visualize it, I think.
Yeah, that is. Mark, thank you.
Thanks.
I will try to remember that, because that's a
good way to think of it, having that actual visual.
You bet. Thank you very much. You wrote about the ozone hole not long ago. And maybe first, what's ozone?
So the ozone is up in the stratosphere, the good ozone. It can be a pollution when it's down on the ground, but it's formed up in the stratosphere. And what it does is it protects us from UV radiation. It helps protect us from that. And in the 70s and even earlier, because of chlorofluorocarbons that we were using, man-made ones, they were getting up to the stratosphere and then destroying the ozone layer, causing destruction of the ozone and therefore destroying the ozone layer. And there were rules, the government got involved. They realized the danger in this. They made guidelines about what people can do and what industries can do, which led to the reduction of chlorofluorocarbons. And as a result, the ozone layer is, again, the amount of ozone up there, which is important, has increased concentrations. And so we're getting back to where we were normally. And it's an example to me that, we can cause problems and we can also fix them. But once we know we have a problem, we need to get on board and fix it.
Yeah, and it was not only the U.S.,
right,
but it was everybody everywhere.
Yeah, because it was a global problem. Yeah.
And how often has that happened that we've had that?
Not enough.
Not enough.
Not enough.
Yeah. Well, Jim wants to know about snowflakes. How are snowflakes formed?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Two things. One is, in order to get, whether it's a liquid drop or an ice crystal, but we'll stay with snowflakes, you need to get the air to a relative humidity of near 100% or near 100% of saturation. You also need a nuclei, some kind of small particle that the water molecules can condense on. And once you reach that high humidity, then the water molecules begin to condense on that nuclei. And if it's below freezing, they'll form ice. Now, what shape ice they form is a function of how cold it is, what is the temperature, and what is the amount of water in the atmosphere. So if it's, just below freezing and very humid, you'll get the snowflakes, that we cut out in kindergarten.
Yeah.
If it's really cold and not a lot of water in the atmosphere, then we'll get more of these hexagonal plates, the ones that cause the sun pillars.
And how big or large can a snowflake be?
The biggest snowflake that I had heard of was the size of a dinner plate. And that formed not through an aggregation of a bunch of other crystals, but in a environment that was below freezing but had a lot of humidity in it. And therefore, it could grow to a large size and take on that special form.
Would that be cool to see?
That would be cool to see, yes. Yeah. And actually, I should say, I don't know if it's an official NOAA approved record.
but I like the idea of it and of dinner plate.
I know. Imagine
this. Have 200 of them falling on you.
That'd be, and I don't know if it was a whole snowfall or just one growing in that particular environment. But
oh, man.
A lot of the snowflakes that we get in Wisconsin that are large are an aggregation. So you'll get these snowflakes, often like the ones we cut out in kindergarten, the classical one. And those will stick together easily. And you can form bigger ones that way.
Well, on that happy note,
we out to where it's cold and dry and snow is on the ground.
And John will be back with us probably.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him how the Arctic was.
Steve Ackerman, our guest. Always great to have him come by. Of course, emeritus professor in the Department of Life Sciences, Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. I'm from the Department of Life Sciences Communication. Oh, my goodness. And here we have a great team. This and all of our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, producer Jeff Robbins, who is also a technical director, Lee Rayburn, who's a TD, but also does on-air for us. We're a mixed group here. Our executive producer, she's on the air too, but she's the boss, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.